Welcome to the Femme Health Podcast, where we focus on providing clarity and evidence-based facts in female health and wellness. The internet, or as us physicians like to say, Dr. Google, can be overwhelming for patients seeking reliable information. And unfortunately, not all of that information is backed by research, science, and real doctors. Here, we pride ourselves on demystifying medicine for you and giving you access to some of the most talented medical doctors who are experts in their field. I'm your host, Dr. Sai Nagori, and I interview doctors so you can have an inside look at what I would ask my colleagues if I had a medical question. Let's get started with today's episode. So on today's show, we're going to be talking about the actual process of getting an epidural. So last time Dr. Hyman was on the show, she discussed with us the myths and truths to getting an epidural. So this time we're going to take the discussion even deeper into the actual process of getting one. So I'm a patient, I'm in labor, I've decided I want the epidural. Dr. Hyman, welcome back to the show and let's start talking again.
I'm so glad to be back, Saya. I think this is going to be a really important conversation to help allay fears about getting an epidural. And it's really nice to know what the process is going to entail when you're in the comfort of your home before you're actually in a hospital about to have a baby. So I think this will be very, very useful.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I think when people come into the labor and delivery floor, they're probably overwhelmed with so many things and so many changes that are about to happen. And in those moments, they need to decide if they're getting the epidural and then understand what that entails. So hopefully today's episode will help a lot of our listeners understand that process beforehand so they have a good deal of knowledge when they are in the situation to make an educated decision and understand what's happening around them.
Exactly.
So tell me, I come in, what's the first thing that the anesthesiologist is going to ask me to do?
So we discussed in the last podcast that the anesthesiologist will obviously do a thorough assessment of the patient and their history and then explain what to expect for the actual epidural process. Once it's actually time to place the epidural, the position that the patient is most typically in is actually sitting up. And her knees will be right against the edge of the bed with her legs dangling off the side of the hospital bed.
And is their back straight or is it curved or...
So it's very important to have excellent positioning during epidural placement. It makes it much more technically easy for the anesthesiologist. So the best position is, first of all, sitting super still. That always helps. You should tuck your chin down to your chest and relax your shoulders, and then round the low part of your back out towards the anesthesiologist. If you do yoga, it's like the cat pose in yoga. Really rounding that back and staying as still as possible will make the procedure go as smoothly as possible.
And physiologically, what is the science behind rounding the back towards the anesthesiologist?
It opens up the vertebral spaces so that we can go in between to find the epidural space and also makes the anatomy easier to feel by bringing the bones of the spine closer to the surface so that the anesthesiologist knows exactly where to go for epidural placement.
Okay, so the back is curved. You prep the area, correct?
Right. So we'll use a antibiotic solution that's cold and wet to prep the skin to make everything very sterile. It's a sterile procedure. The anesthesiologist will clean their hands, place a plastic drape that's also sterile over the patient's back with an opening in the low back where the actual procedure will take place.
Okay. And then you had mentioned this in the last podcast, but you numb the area before the actual epidural needle is placed, correct?
Yeah, so the most uncomfortable part of epidural placement is the numbing medication or the local anesthesia, which is the first real step after prepping and draping. So that will feel like a pinch followed by a lot of burning. The needle that we use for that is actually quite small. Like I said last time, it's really even smaller than the needle you would use for drawing blood. It's a big pinch and a burn, similar to what you feel if a dentist has ever numbed up a tooth. Sometimes people have experienced that before.
Okay, great. Just to get a little bit more clarity, what kind of medications are used in both the actual local numbing and then the actual epidural that's helping with the labor pain?
So the local numbing is most typically lidocaine, which is a local anesthesia, which numbs up the skin and the nerves beneath the skin. People have heard of Novocaine normally from the dentist. Lidocaine is just more modern local anesthetic. The medication that's actually used once the epidural is in place is typically a mixture of both a local anesthetic, usually something either called bupivacaine or sometimes ropivacaine. These are longer acting local anesthetics than lidocaine, and also a opioid medication. The combination of the two medicines, the local anesthetic or numbing medicine and the opioid medicine, work better than either alone, and then you have fewer side effects since you can use lower medication overall.
Okay, so let's say we've prepped and draped, we've numbed the back for the actual epidural needle. Can you tell me how you place the epidural needle?
So once the back is numb, the epidural space is found using the epidural needle, which is slowly advanced through the ligaments that surround the patient's spine. And as you pass through those ligaments, there's sort of characteristic resistance that anesthesiologists are very used to feeling. And that resistance is checked by attaching a syringe to the end of the epidural needle, and that syringe is filled with either air or saline. And as you slowly advance through those ligaments, there's resistance when you tap on that syringe. Once you've passed through those ligaments into the epidural space, there's no more resistance. It's called the loss of resistance technique, and that's when the anesthesiologist knows that, that the epidural space has been encountered.
And what happens then?
So then the epidural catheter, and catheter is a medical term for a tube, basically, the tube, which is very, very small, about the thickness of angel hair pasta, if not smaller, is passed through that needle into the epidural space. And during this part, it's pretty common for a patient to feel a little sort of shooting sensation, like if you've hit your funny bone, as the catheter passes past some nerve roots in the space. Nothing dangerous about that. It just can feel a little funny and be startling if the patient's not aware. And once that catheter is inside the epidural space, the epidural needle, which was used to access the space, is removed. That feels like pressure. And then all needles are out. And it's just that very skinny tube that's left in the low back. And that's the epidural.
And how does it stay in there?
It gets secured with a sterile dressing and then lots of tape on the back. And, you know, we tape it up really well since we don't want it to move at all during labor and delivery, even if the patient moves around a lot. And then it will get hooked up to the medication for the pain control.
The shooting sensation before, where would they feel that? In their legs or?
Either the low back, kind of like down into the buttocks, or down one leg, the other leg, or both legs. So it's kind of a shooting down sensation. And it's pretty common. Not everyone feels it, but it's pretty common.
And does that indicate at all, if it's down one leg or down another leg, where the anesthesia may be? Like, would it be more one-sided or on the other side or not necessarily?
The shooting sensation occurs probably just because the epidural is going past some nerve roots. So it doesn't necessarily predict where the epidural catheter will end up exactly. So it's hard to know if that means epidural is going to be stronger on one side or the other, but that can happen. And we can talk about that later. But I don't think that that how the patient feels as the catheter is advancing could necessarily predict that.
Okay. And then another sort of question on this process is, so the catheter is in, the medication's being delivered. Is that a steady flow of medication? Is the patient able to push a button or pump for an extra dose if they feel extra pain?
Yeah, so typically we first give what we call a bolus dose or a larger dose of medication to get the epidural kind of activated. After that initial dose of medication is in, then the patient is connected up to an infusion pump where there is medication automatically administered for the whole rest of labor and delivery. And then at many centers, there's also a patient demand dose. So a button attached to this infusion pump that the patient has easy access to, where she can push a button if she's feeling extra pain to give herself an extra dose of medication. And these infusion pumps always are very safe. There's a lockout mechanism, meaning that certain time frame after which you can request another dose, or the machine won't give you an extra dose too soon so the patient can't overdose themselves. It's very, very safe.
Okay, great. Yeah, because I can imagine if you're in that much pain, you may just keep pushing that button.
If that is happening, first of all, the machine won't overdose you, so it's very safe. But that's the time when the patient should call the nurse to have the nurse find the anesthesiologist, because the anesthesiologist has ways to troubleshoot catheters and also can give stronger medications. So we talked a lot in the last podcast about how we use much more dilute medications now in modern practice, which is good. It's been shown to lead to better outcomes, but it means that some patients will need extra doses of medication that the anesthesiologist can administer herself or himself. And so patients shouldn't be shy and should definitely ask for that if they need it.
And what is the onset of this medication? So the catheter's in, infusion's going in, and I have my pump in my hand. How soon can I expect to feel relief?
So that's a really good question. So I haven't mentioned so far that there are actually a couple of variations on the classic epidural, which I described. There is an extra step that you can do if you want the epidural to work really, really fast. So to answer your question, a traditional epidural will start taking effect in about 15 to 20 minutes. The patient should have really good pain relief. Now, you can imagine that if someone is getting close to fully dilated or even in early labor but has excruciating pain, 20 minutes could seem like a really long time. So we can actually make it work even faster by doing something called this combined spinal epidural. That technique involves, so once the epidural needle is in the epidural space, just before we thread that tube, one extra step is taken where a super skinny needle is passed through the epidural needle a little bit farther into the spinal fluid. And a small dose of medication is administered directly into the spinal fluid. Then that tiny needle is withdrawn and the epidural is placed and the rest of the procedure continues as I described above. That technique can lead to good pain control within 3 to 5 minutes. So that's a great option for patients who have a lot of pain, are in advanced labor, or have had a lot of babies in the past, and labor is likely to go quickly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's good to keep in mind. So if it's a second or third or fourth child, their labor process may be much faster. So that's something that you can do to help them achieve pain control faster.
Yeah. And the major downside to that technique is when opioid medications go right into the spinal fluid, a side effect is pretty intense itching. And we'll talk about side effects later, but one of the side effects of epidurals in general is itching. It can be more intense with the combined spinal epidural technique, but it's usually a worthwhile trade-off if you're in a lot of pain to have immediate pain relief, even at the expense of a bit of itching.
And where does the epidural take effect? So this is sort of a two-part question. I want to know where I'm going to be numb from, and then also the question I had touched on before, can one side get numb more than the other?
Great. So it's really the upper abdomen down where you get numb. So you don't feel much in your chest or your hands or your face. You shouldn't. So you will feel a sense of warmth, numbness, tingling from the abdomen down. And it's actually fairly common to have one side get more numb than the other. Probably it's hard to know exactly. Numbers vary from study to study, but maybe around 20% of patients where one side will be much more numb than the other. And that's not actually a problem as long as the pain control is adequate on both sides. If that isn't the case and contractions are felt more strongly on one side than the other, then the anesthesiologist needs to troubleshoot the catheter.
And that would involve repositioning it?
Often repositioning it. If you pull it back slightly, you can imagine the epidural catheter going a little bit to one side or the other in the epidural space. Since the catheter is passed, there's no way to guide it directly. It can go a little to one side or the other. If you pull it back, in theory, it can help it come back into the middle. So that often works well. Giving stronger, larger doses of medication can help get that other side more comfortable just by nature of medication being able to spread better. And then worst case scenario, if an epidural is truly one-sided and the patient has a lot of pain on one side versus the other, despite those measures, then we'll just replace the epidural.
Okay. So you pull that catheter out and basically do it again.
Exactly. And you have to go through the procedure again. But it's worthwhile if the pain is just not being able to be adequately controlled. And it's rare that we do that, but it does happen.
And let's say I'm in labor for, I don't know, something really long, 35 hours or something crazy. Is it okay for me to have an epidural that entire time? Because, you know, you come into labor, you're not sure how long you're going to be in it. And, you know, I, knowing myself, I'll probably be like, yeah, give me it. Give me it as soon as possible. And then what if I labor for like 30 hours? Is that okay for me to be having that medication the whole time?
Absolutely. So the medication is given at, you know, safe doses, very little of it gets into your bloodstream. There's no long-term effects of receiving these medications. And there's really no limit to the duration of how long you can have an epidural. And actually, for comparison, when patients get epidurals for post-operative pain relief after surgery, sometimes they're left in for days to up to a week. So certainly, you know, a day to 2 days of labor is totally safe.
Okay, great. And we had touched on this a little bit before, but can you tell me some of the main side effects that patients should expect when they get an epidural?
Definitely. So I mentioned the itching. That's very common, more intense with the combined spinal epidural, but happens even with the regular epidural. It's usually not too intense, just more of a nuisance. And most patients would choose itching over pain any day.
Is that itching local?
It's kind of diffuse over your whole body, actually.
Oh, so it's not just...
That's a side effect. Yeah, that's a side effect of the opioid medication.
Okay, so the itching side effect is not where the needle is placed necessarily. It's all over your body.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah. Other side effects include low blood pressure. I mentioned that in the other podcast. The medications, as they're administered in the epidural space, can bring the blood pressure lower. Maybe about 10% of patients who have epidurals for labor will have hypotension. And this is something that we watch for very closely after epidural placement and treat with fluids and sometimes medications if necessary. So that's another side effect. Other side effects include obviously feeling the numbness and tingling. With larger doses of medication, you can start to have a little bit of weakness of your muscles, although we try to find the sweet spot where patients' pain is controlled without having too much weakness.
I have also heard that people can get a headache.
Right. So far we've talked about side effects of epidurals, including low blood pressure, itching, the numbness and tingling. But the next obvious topic of conversation then has to be complications, which are inherent risk of any procedure. Luckily, most complications are rare with epidurals, but the spinal headache that you mentioned is the most common complication. It happens about 1% of the time when we do epidurals. And the reason that it happens is because of a leakage of spinal fluid, which leads to a headache, which is very unique. There's no other headache in medicine that acts like this. And what I mean when I say that is that this headache goes away when you lie down flat, and you only feel it if you sit up or stand up. And so we know that that headache is a spinal headache or a postdural puncture headache is the official term for it. And we know it came from the epidural and we have ways to treat it.
And how long does that last?
So if it happens, it typically starts several hours, more commonly a day or even more after the epidural placement. So the good news is if you end up getting the headache, it's usually not while you're in labor. So it's after that. So at least that's behind you. The natural history of it, I mean, if left untreated, is that it will last several days to a week or maybe 2 weeks. Most patients with a brand new baby do not want to have a headache every time they sit up or stand up.
Right.
So patients, that's pretty miserable. So patients generally opt to have treatment.
And what's the treatment?
So conservative treatments are medications, pain medications, staying well hydrated, lying down as much as you can, although, you know, that's not that much fun. Caffeine can actually help. But the sort of standard treatment if those measures fail, which they often do, to be honest, is to do something called an epidural blood patch, which is a procedural fix to the headache.
Oh, okay. And so in about 1% of patients, they may get the spinal headache as a complication. How many of those on average would have to have the epidural blood patch to resolve their headache?
So that is probably going to be very patient dependent and center dependent. I think some centers, the anesthesia departments are going to be more aggressive about offering the blood patch earlier than others. So it's hard to know an exact number. In my clinical practice, somewhere between maybe a half to three quarters of the patients end up wanting to have the blood patch because they just want the headache to go away when they have a new baby.
And you're saying that it would probably go away on its own in about a week to a week and a half?
The majority of them, but not all of them.
Okay, so if it's lasted longer than a week or a week and a half, then the blood patch may be a good idea.
Yes, and some patients don't even want to wait the week to 2 weeks for it to get better on its own, and we'll have the blood patch, you know, on the first or second day after having the baby. So that's also an option. The patient's really the boss in this scenario. It depends on how miserable they are with the headache, how eager they are to undergo another procedure. And some patients will just want to do the other procedure and get it over with and get back on their feet. And other patients want to wait and see and then end up coming back to the hospital for this procedure. And some patients don't end up needing it. So it's really a case-by-case basis. And if you are the unfortunate, 1% of patients to get this complication, the anesthesiologists are always, there to take care of you to help in any way, shape, or form.
Awesome. That's good to know. I have another question about the whole epidural process. At the end, is it just pulled out of you?
Yeah. So at the end, it's just pulled out of you very gently. You don't feel the catheter itself coming out. It's nothing, you know, not a big deal at all. Actually, the most uncomfortable part about the pulling of the catheter is just the tape coming off your back. You know how it stings when you remove a Band-Aid? It's a lot of tape, so it's uncomfortable coming off the back. But the catheter itself is so small that the patient can't even feel when we remove it.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. It's funny that you say that, because when I do cataract surgery, we have to, you know, put tape and dressing on the eye. And I tell my patients the same thing. I said, this is probably the worst part, because you have to yank the tape off and it can be pretty painful.
Absolutely.
So the catheter comes out. Is it that process of the catheter coming out that leads to the headache? Like, if the catheter is still in you, is a spinal headache not likely?
No, the spinal headache comes from the needle, the epidural needle, making a tiny hole in the dura, which is the last sort of layer of tissue before the spinal fluid. So most of the time, that's probably most of the time how it happens, is that the needle, the epidural needle, actually makes a little hole in the dura. The catheter in itself could, in theory, as well, and I'm sure that does happen in some cases, but the catheter is pretty soft and flexible, so it's more often that the actual needle ends up causing that little hole that then leads to the spinal fluid leak and then leads to the headache.
And once the catheter is pulled out, how long do you have pain control after that? I mean, at what point, once it's pulled out, should you expect to get sensation back?
So it varies from patient to patient, somewhere from 1 hour to maybe 6 hours. It's pretty variable. The numbness and tingling will go away, and then the pain from delivery will start to come on. And obviously pain medications will be offered to help with that once the epidural has worn off.
And going along the lines of not being able to walk, so I imagine there's DVT prophylaxis, which, for our listeners, anytime a patient is immobilized for a long period of time, we want to prevent against blood clots. So I'm sure that's something that is done for patients who are getting epidurals as well.
So the DVT prevention is always a moving target, and it's something that the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, ACOG, is always updating guidelines on. It's actually not routine to do any particular prevention for vaginal deliveries, even with the epidural, because the risk is pretty low and patients are still moving around in bed, and patients are pretty mobile pretty quickly after vaginal delivery. With patients having cesarean sections, there is significantly more of an effort to prevent DVT because the inflammatory response to the surgery can increase the risk. But with vaginal delivery, actually, the risk is pretty low, although it's always a moving target and there's always more research studies and that can change.
Okay, so Jamie, another question. If I am laboring for a really long time, let's say, you know, 30 to 36 hours, is there a certain point where I should get the epidural? I mean, I would personally want the pain control throughout. And I've seen a lot of varying things online as to how long I should wait, or a doctor may not give it to me at a certain time. Can you comment a little bit on that?
That's a really great question, and I'm so glad you asked it. I actually, just out of curiosity, Googled the question, what is the best time to get an epidural? And the first several dozen responses said something along the lines of waiting until you're at least 4 centimeters dilated. And I was so surprised to see that, because it's a really old recommendation based on old studies, or really honestly old wives' tales, that you shouldn't get an epidural too early in labor because it could delay labor, it could make you have an increased risk of having a C-section. And it turns out that that's really just been disproven, and there's no reason to wait in terms of, you know, your ultimate outcome for having a vaginal delivery or how long the labor is going to take. I said in the other podcast, the one reason that I actually understand from the patient's standpoint for waiting is that you do have to be in bed at many centers once the epidural is in. So that may be a reason to wait, but certainly, you know, writhing in pain waiting because you think you need to wait till you're 4 centimeters is outdated, and epidurals should, you know, be asked for as soon as the patient feels ready.
Of course, I totally agree with that, and it would be doing a disservice to the patient to have them have to suffer through what could be probably excruciating pain.
Definitely. And I'll add in one other thing, which is that we often can place epidurals in patients coming in for induction of labor before that process even starts. So the patient has no pain at all and can have the epidural preemptively and then not have to really experience any severe pain. So there's certainly no downside to that. There's no downside to getting it in early labor before the pain is severe. And we're also very used to placing epidurals in patients who are having tremendous pain and helping patients through that as well.
So it seems that as long as the patient is able to stay still, there's really no unsafe time to give the epidural.
Absolutely.
And they just need to be usually immobile. So that would mean implications for having to use a bedpan, which patients may or may not like, but that would be one reason why they delay it a little bit to shorten the amount of time that they are not able to get up and go to the bathroom or walk around.
Exactly. At some places, you won't be able to walk around, although you will be able to move around in bed, shift from side to side, sit up. So you're not completely immobile, but may not be able to walk. So that would be a reason to delay if that's something that is important to you, for sure.
Dr. Hyman, before we sign off here, you know, I wanted to get your thoughts on one last thing. There's a lot of information out there and articles and such that maybe inadvertently put a lot of pressure on women to birth naturally and making even women feel guilty about having epidurals and having pain control. From our discussion, it's very clear that epidurals are very safe and they can really alleviate a lot of the pain involved in the labor process. So can you comment a little bit about some of the guilt that some women may experience if they choose to get an epidural?
I'm so glad you asked. As a woman, I definitely want to support all other women's choices on how to deliver and what they want their birth experience to be like. However, as an anesthesiologist, my heart breaks a little bit whenever I encounter a patient who really wanted to do labor and delivery without an epidural and then feels like she failed when she asks us to come and place it. It does break my heart because I don't want them to be disappointed in themselves or in the birth process, and especially because they are so safe. And I just don't think there's any reason why someone has to suffer through tremendous pain, especially when they're about to take on an incredibly, you know, tough challenge of being a new mom. So I never want patients to feel that way. And actually, interestingly, there was recently a study that showed that patients who came into the hospital with a plan to deliver without an epidural, but then ended up getting an epidural for whatever reason, maybe the pain was too much, maybe there was some complication with the delivery, maybe they ended up needing a cesarean section, that having that plan to deliver without an epidural and then ending up getting one led to an increased risk of having postpartum depression. So it's hard to know exactly why that could. Yeah, I know. So it's hard to know exactly why that could happen. It may be that just the increased pain led to the increased risk of depression, but it may actually be that sense of personal failure. Like, I was going to do it without, and I had to get one and I failed. And so, you know, if I could leave everyone with any message, it would be, you know, a healthy mom, healthy baby. And however you get to that process, you definitely haven't failed. It's an amazing experience. So
thank you so much for all your thoughts and for taking time and educating me, educating our listeners. It's such a valuable topic. I know I've learned so much, you know, and I am a physician, so there were so many gaps in my knowledge on this process. So I really appreciate you taking time and educating us all on the modern day process. I really think that the final comments that you made are especially very important, that, you know, this is why modern medicine exists. It's so that people can have pain control and can make things easier. You know, one of the analogies that I'll make before we sign off here is you wouldn't expect anyone to undergo major surgery without anesthesia. People really shouldn't feel a personal sense of failure if they had decided ahead of time that they weren't going to get it, but then due to unbearable pain or really long labor process, decided to get the epidural. Because for any other surgical situation, you would never even imagine that someone would go through any kind of surgery without appropriate pain control. So again, I agree with you. I totally respect every woman's choice to however she wants to have her baby, but no one should feel bad if they do choose to have an epidural.
I couldn't agree more.
Okay, great. Well, you know, Dr. Jamie Hyman, who is an expert anesthesiologist at Mount Sinai, has spent a long time talking to us and sharing her insight. I just want to say again, thank you so much, Dr. Hyman, for sharing your insight with us, all based in science and evidence-based medicine, for letting our listeners know that there's been a lot of changes in the world of epidurals over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, and a lot of the information online is outdated and not necessarily applicable to how medicine is practiced today. You know, any final comments to share?
I just really enjoyed talking with you, Dr. Nagori, about this topic, and I hope that it will provide comfort to patients about to have babies before the day they actually have to go in and their heads are spinning with, you know, all of the incoming information as well as the excitement of having a baby. So I think this will be really useful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I really hope that patients are able to get a grasp of what this is like before they have to learn about it in a situation that is not necessarily going to be calm. And I totally agree. And hopefully, if we can get more people educated, it'll make your job easier too when you have to explain to someone about this process when they're about to have a baby. We always like to include a quick but important disclaimer that the views expressed on this podcast are the individual views of doctors and do not represent any institution or organization that the doctors are affiliated with. What is most important about our podcast is that everything you hear is backed by science and evidence-based medicine.